Welcome to The Hidden Edge, the go-to podcast on mental fitness for business leaders and their teams, by me, Jody Rogers, peak performance consultant to world-leading organizations. People are listening, and I'm like, I'm ready to roar. So that's me. What about you, Jeff?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I have a saying that COVID has democratized mental ill health. It's democratized this conversation. You know, I mean, we all talk about the, and it's very front of mind, the physical effects of COVID. Yeah. We all know a dry cough and a, you know, a high temperature and a loss of taste and smell. We seldom talk about the psychological effects that COVID is having. And the factors that are bringing about those effects, there's not a single person in the world who is immune to any of those factors. For example, a disruption to social connections. As you said, we are all about connection, relationship. That's been hugely disrupted for every single one of us, which has an impact on our psychological health. There has been unbelievable uncertainty for all of us, And we all know that uncertainty is a huge, huge driver of anxiety and feeling anxious. We've all had to change and have seen changes in our family system. I mean, here am I sitting in South Africa. My wife and my daughters are back home. Why? Because of COVID, you know? I mean, they had to get back. I didn't have to get back. But it hasn't been great being separated from them. You know, we've all had to adapt to this working from home, virtual working. So, you know, those are just some of the factors. There are people out there that are, depending upon the industry they're in, that are hugely, hugely concerned about their financial security going forward. So those factors, nobody's immune to those factors. And therefore, in many ways, this pandemic has democratized mental ill health. Mm-hmm. It's opened up this conversation. You know, as you say, or the guy said to you, it's kicked down the door. It sure has. But it's democratized it because there was a time when, I'm a CEO and I'm a tough guy and I can get on with, well, some of those are finding that they're not as, as tough and as macho as they thought they might have been. And so they would like to have this conversation now.
We all know they're the ones most under pressure with the least sleep at night. And we know imposter syndrome, and it gets worse. It gets more magnified the higher up the food chain you go. It's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you saying, Jeff? I know you've been doing for the audience who don't know you, can you share a little bit about, we obviously know each other from Unilever, and then you left Unilever and I know what you're doing now, but can you share a little bit about leaving and what you've been up to since? And then I'd like to ask you what you've seen over the last year, because I know you're active in this space.
Sure. As you say, we know each other from our Unilever days. And what you might have not known about me in my Unilever days was that in 2008, I got very, very ill with anxiety-fueled depression. But my ability to talk about my illness, my ability to share that with close colleagues, family, and friends saved my life in my darkest, darkest moments. I mean, I had to take 3 months off work. I had very, very dark moments during my recovery. But the only thing that kept me going in probably some of my darkest moments was knowing how much I was loved. Talk about the power of love. I don't know how many songs have been sung about the power of love. And yes, I get myself better. And by the way, I always refer to myself as somebody who works hard every single day at maintaining my mental fitness. Very hard every single day, because I am and continue to be in recovery mode. I am somebody who is susceptible to anxiety-fueled depression. But I get myself better, I slowly recover, come back into Unilever, in 2012, 4 years after my crucible moment in life, one of my closest friends dies by suicide. And I lie in bed that night and I reflect on his loss. And I come to two insights. The one is, I've been able to ask for help. He couldn't. And the other is that stigma had just killed my friend. Because had he had a physical illness, I know what he'd have done. He would have gone and asked for some help. But because he was struggling mentally and emotionally, he didn't think he could ask for any help. And instead, he died by suicide. And so that night, I wrote to Alistair Campbell, back in 2012, was advocating, he was doing a bit of campaigning. And, you know, this was Jeff MacDonald at btinternet.com writing to Alistair. This wasn't Tony Blair writing to Alistair Campbell. Within 10 minutes, I had a response from him. A week later, we met up in Belsize Park, close to where he lives in North London. And ever since that day, November of 2012, he began to introduce me to some people, which allowed me to take tiny footsteps on a journey filled with a very deep sense of purpose. And that is to create friendship groups, family groups, and workplaces all over the world where every single person feels they genuinely have the choice to just put their hand up and ask for some help if they might be struggling with a common form of mental ill health. As you might have recalled, I then co-led a piece of work with Tim Munden in the UK around addressing the stigma of mental ill health. We saw some of the impact that had. I began to share my story in Unilever. And after seeing the impact, I left Unilever at the end of 2014 and have followed that journey ever since. And it's taken me to people and it's taken me to places I could never, ever have imagined.
Wow, fantastic. I've heard some of your story before because I love what you do, and I like, if I see that you're on something, I'm there watching. I actually hadn't heard the Alistair Campbell story actually. So that's really it's heartwarming, first of all, that he did reach out to Jeff at btyfi.com. And when you say, so what I've heard is that you then went on a journey of it sounds like connecting people and bringing people together in order to feel safe that they could speak up. What exactly was that? Was it creating communities? Was it?
No, there are two things I've done, really. I mean, on the one hand, Jody, I've had to make sure there's a bit of food on the table at the end of every month. And so the journey on the one hand has been a journey of catalyzing this conversation in the most senior levels of organizations all over the world. But not only catalyzing the conversation, but actually leaving them with a framework and some ideas on what would good practice look like if we were able to truly create an environment where people felt they could put their hand up and ask for some help. So the one avenue of my work is around speaking engagements and catalyzing these conversations amongst executive teams, extended leadership teams. And more recently, that challenge has become more about not only mental health, but why are you not seeing the health of your people as a strategic priority in your business? Because I can tell you, COVID has shown us that when we're not healthy, look what happens to the performance of businesses, of economies, of individuals all over the world. So why is health like a well-being week, where we have 1 week in the year where we care for you, and then the other 51 weeks of the year, I just flog you to death. But guess what? I care for you because we had our well-being week. Well, we've decided that we're going to have a few bananas next to the till in the canteen now. And we're going to get rid of all the sweets in meetings, and we're going to have nuts and bananas and fruit. And I mean, there is nothing strategic about that. And so that has become a real challenge. And not only challenging, but through all the insights, and the lessons I've learned in the 8 years is leaving them with a framework around what would that look like? You know, if the health and well-being of your people were a strategic priority, this is what it would look like. Now get on and execute it, because it's the most valuable asset, the most valuable asset that you have. I always used to say in HR, Jody, you know, people are our most important asset. I don't say that anymore. The energy, the health of our people is our most important asset. Because when I was so sick, I had all the knowledge, I had all the skills, I had all the behaviors, I had all the experience to do my job. You know what I didn't have? My health. So I couldn't do it. So that's my one avenue of work. And then the other avenue of work, and it's not work, but I co-founded a charity called Minds at Work. And that is what you were talking about earlier. Through this charity over the last 4 years, we've kind of grown its membership stroke participation. And it's not a membership charity. You can just participate. But it is about bringing people together to inspire them and to equip them to go back into their workplaces and get this conversation going, break the stigma of mental ill health. And we do that through running events throughout the year where people, it doesn't matter what level you are, doesn't matter what color you are, what gender you are, you can come to our events and hopefully feel inspired and feel equipped to go and get this conversation going. And the last thing that I would say is, I know I was so lucky that Alistair did respond to my to my message. And you know what it taught me? There's not a single message, not a single interaction that I will get from anybody that I will not respond to. You know, when I'm talking, I mean, LinkedIn, I mean, you know, you do a session and suddenly the messages come in and the stories come in. And I've just made it my, I've made it a rule that I will respond to every single one, because I was so lucky that he responded to me.
Love that. You know, you made me think of, I think it was Ringo Starr from the Beatles. I'm maybe getting this wrong, I need to check. He used to write reply to every single fan for 20 years. And then at one point, he just couldn't do it anymore. But you can imagine how many they were getting. But,
yeah.
You know, through the thread of what you were saying, twice the same thought came into my head, which was, the fact that we all need, as humans, we need love, connection, and significance. And actually, when you reply to people, they feel seen, they feel significant, and that can go a long way in sense of self-worth and value, and I'm not lost. And also when you were talking, Jeff, I feel like we've come across a similar insight. And tell me if I'm wrong, but in my own journey of talking about this, I find that people aren't motivated by the pain. And what I mean by that is, like, we know there's empirical evidence that supports if you can say to people, you're going to die of heart disease if you don't stop doing this thing. And whilst consciously they understand that, they continue the behavior because of secondary gains or whatever it might be. And I feel the same way when we talk about this topic. If we paint the horror show of what's at cost, even if that's the financial cost, I feel like it doesn't quite, we don't get the traction. And what I've started to do is, I actually, and I feel like we're doing very similar things. I've started to paint the picture of, if we invest in the hearts and minds of our people, it's good for people, it's good for business, it's good for society. Now, you can work out the people part and therefore the society part. Why is it good for business? And everyone is talking about agility and adaptability and uncertainty, and we need a resilient workforce. Well, how do you get that? A workforce doesn't exist. It's a collection of people. So if we invest into the hearts and minds of people, it's going to pay dividends into the business, increase production, retention, engagement, all of the things. And so that's the argument that I'm starting to make, so much so that we've created a business case for it to try and go, it's, yes, there's a cost of not doing it, but actually what's the benefit of doing it?
Oh, Jodie, I love that. I love it. And my narrative is so similar. You know, of course there's a cost, absenteeism, presenteeism. We know all of it. We know that. But why can't we talk the benefit? Why can't we talk the upside of doing this? As you say, a more attractive place to work, greater retention, increased productivity, greater engagement, greater capacity to get things done in the organization when people are healthy and well, mentally, emotionally, and physically. And the other thing that I think you might like, being a marketing, having a sort of marketing, some marketing blood in you, all right? Is I often say brand mental health is the most damaged brand I have ever, ever come across. So when people talk to me and I use the words mental health, people immediately go to illness. They go to depression, they go to anxiety, they go to schizophrenia, they go to bipolar. When I use the word physical health, people don't immediately go to cancer, glandular fever, COVID. If I'm in Regent Street in London and I walk into a Nike store or an Adidas store or a Reebok store, what do I see plastered all over the walls? Apart from their brand emblem, what do I see plastered all over the walls in those stores?
Healthy, fit people.
Exactly. I call them chiseled whippets. Okay. And then I walk into that store and I look at my own body and I think, shit, jeepers, I wouldn't mind a body like that. I feel quite inspired by the image. Yeah. And I go and buy myself a pair of running shoes. Eh? What are the images you see when it comes to mental health?
The negative ones.
Exactly. Jeff McDonald with his hand in his head, mm-hmm. black and white photograph, some mental asylum, mm-hmm. white coat on. What is inspirational and aspirational about mental fitness?
About mental health.
And mental health. There's nothing inspirational. There aren't those images that, as you say, portray the upside, the benefits of mental health.
Well, and that's why, God, we're so aligned. It's brilliant. That's why we talk about mental fitness, which I've got here. And I don't think we've cracked it either, but it's in an attempt to put the energy and focus above the line, not below
Absolutely.
The line.
Absolutely.
And change the conversation and make the conversation accessible and make it aspirational and excite people behind what's possible. And I haven't thought about it in those terms, but the language you put to it is perfect. It needs rebranded, desperately needs rebranded. And we do, I've not thought about this either, but just with any brand, we need the imagery to bring it to life. I think the hard thing is, because mental anything is internal, it's like, how do you project that? But of course you can, because it's confidence. That's what it is. It's happiness. It's fulfillment. It's being able to face challenge and give it a go anyway, instead of running away in the other direction. It's fascinating. I love it. Tell me, Jeff, what have you seen then in the last, because you've been, I think you've been at the coalface a bit longer than me. And I would love to hear how you've seen things change in the last year when it comes to this conversation. And I can share a little bit about what I've seen. I'm seeing it very much in the leadership space more than anywhere else, but I know you have a broader spread than that.
Yeah, what have I seen? I mean, I think as I mentioned earlier, I think the first thing that I've seen is that over the last year, COVID has democratized mental ill health. You know, I have seen the psychological effects that COVID is having on people, driven by some of those factors I spoke about earlier that none of us are immune from, whether that's social connection, uncertainty, financial insecurity, changes to the family system, working from home. So the first thing I've seen is workplaces really opening up about wanting to at least have the conversation about mental health and mental ill health in particular. I think that's the first thing that I've seen. And you know, Jody, I often say, and I think you might resonate with this, that a good old Irishman of Irish descent called John F. Kennedy once started a conversation about putting a man on the moon and bringing him back safely. Well, guess what had happened? And so as we can have more of these conversations now, I think anything becomes possible in terms of some of the ambition you talk about around mental health and mental fitness in particular. I think that's the first thing that I've seen. I think the second thing that I've seen is I've seen CEOs, chief financial officers, less inclined to roll their eyes when you use the term well-being. So I think I have seen a genuine desire from, in the main, the larger organizations to truly, truly show some concern for employee well-being during this time. And therefore, well-being, health of employees has kind of moved up the agenda in terms of priorities. I mean, there's a report, I should try and remind me, if you just drop me a mail after this, I'll send it to you. But PwC have just done, they've interviewed 100 CEOs all over the world. And they've asked them, you know, during the pandemic, what and coming out of this pandemic, what are your priorities going forward? And well-being is there. Well-being of employees is there. So, you know, I've also seen, I'll tell you what else I've seen. I've seen organizations starting to become more human, more compassionate towards their people. Now, I'm not sure whether that's going to last, but while we're in the midst of the pandemic, there are much more compassionate and human conversations taking place in these larger organizations that I kind of have been associated with. You know, I think there's a forgotten sector, which is the small, medium-sized enterprise sector. But I believe that, you know, in that sector, you know, you've got CEOs and you've got individuals really concerned about the health and the well-being of their people. The issue for me is they don't know what to do about this. They don't know what to do about it. And that's why I think whether you want to call it experts, whether you want to call it thought leaders, whether you want to call them advocates, activists, consultants, coming to the fore and beginning to support and help, you know, these leadership teams, these executives, to answer the question, okay, if I've got to try and enhance and raise the importance of health and well-being as an agenda item in this organization, what must I do? What does that look like? Yeah. And I think that's missing right now.
Yeah, and it makes me think of what you said at the beginning, which is the topic of mental health has become democratized. What is missing is we need a democratized solution.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
It made me think, actually, it's a really good point about the kind of small business and middle business being missing. And we've done some work for a big bank, and they've actually on this topic, and they have externalized that content onto
Wonderful.
I can actually say it because it's Barclays LifeWorks.
Right.
And they've externalized it so that it's free. They've just done it this week, actually. So I should really post that because it's got videos, it's got exercises, it's got everything. And we need more of the big companies that have the money to do it to then white label it.
Well, one of the things that we are looking at as Minds at Work, my charity, is we've just prototyped a program, and we've called it Hive. And essentially what it is a peer support program for small business leaders on how to look after their own well-being, their own mental health, such that, because I often say, Jody, you know, if you don't care for your own health, if you don't care for your own well-being, if you can't be compassionate to yourself, you won't care for anybody else's health and you won't be compassionate to anybody else. And so what we're trying to do with this the prototype is like, I don't know, I think it's 9 weeks, 90 minutes, once a week, over 9 weeks. And it's bringing these individuals together, creating a real sense of peer support and teaching them how to look after aspects of their own well-being, their physical, emotional, and mental health. And we've directed it to SMEs. And we are talking to organizations to say, in your supply chain, who are your small, medium-sized enterprises that you are working with? And why don't you support a Hive program and bring some of those individuals, those leaders in, such that they can then go and play a bigger role back in their businesses. So it's something we're piloting. It's a little beta. We've almost finished the first one, and we're going to see where it goes, because I think there's a huge need in that community, in that sector, to offer more support and help.
That's great. It's really great. I've been thinking about, you know, when you said that, and I will ask you, I will find that report or get you to send it to me. Because I'm all about the data and the evidence.
I'm going to send you two. I mean, there's one called The Ethical Leadership also, which has just come out. And you'll see in that the whole well-being agenda, and the other one, the PwC one.
Fantastic. Well, the fact that it damn well should be up there in terms of priorities. And what we saw through the last year is, we work with a lot of big companies, and they panicked, and then they came out with a message to their people, and it was largely the same, but right. They came out with the right message, which was, our priority right now is our people, or they said well-being, and revenue and recession proofing. And we get that, right? Because it's business. The problem is, historically, those things haven't been in conflict with each other. But today, in a COVID world, they are absolutely in conflict with each other. Because what we're observing in our work with leaders and their teams, and we work with people all over the world, is that we're at home, the commute is gone, we're on our screens all day, but what has happened is that time that could have been freed up for fitness, for meditation, for self-care, has actually been filled up with more work. And that is partly because we're all in panic mode, we're trying to predict an unpredictable future, and quite frankly, I don't see leaders making tough choices. I see leaders spreading their eggs, because who can predict this and who wants to take a risk at this time? But what it's actually led to is much more work, much more overwhelm, also an inability from people to be able to set their boundaries, push back and say no, because of fear of judgment, because of fear of losing their job, because of, you know, the environment that we're in. So I'm seeing, you know, the pursuit of keeping businesses afloat and keeping people afloat actually in direct conflict with each other, and has been for the last year. Are you seeing the same thing?
That resonates. So, and the way I would describe it is, I mean, absolutely, we get businesses saying, look at the productivity levels, they really improved, blah, 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 blah. What we're not looking at are the rates of burnout. And the rates of burnout are going through the roof for the exact reasons that you have just described. You know, I get up, I'm still in my pajamas, and I switch on my laptop, and I switch it off at 10 o'clock.
Yep. Yeah.
And it's called burnout. It's not sustainable. It's not sustainable. So, yes, I painted a positive picture, but thank you for reminding us of the sacrifice that some people are showing and their inability to be self-compassionate and to care for themselves, which is then leading to burnout.
And it's back to, we know everything in life kind of comes down to fear and love. And actually that is driven by fear. And actually, I think that there's, like everything in life, we're seeing a lot of positives and we're seeing negatives at the same time, and different things for different people. I'll share a frustration that I have at the minute, which is, you know, and again, this is like I talked about the need for securing revenue or recession proof in a business, uh-huh, and well-being as being really paradoxical, and a paradox that we as leaders we have to manage, and leaders always have to manage paradoxes, you know, speed and quality, sustainability and margin and all of those things.
Yep.
But I think on top of that, what's really important is we manage the paradox of actually productivity and motivation and engagement and people giving way too much to their businesses and therefore depleting their own inner resources and their own ability to recover. And so the frustration for me, being really candid, is we get pulled in to do, you know, mental fitness sessions, resilience sessions, all the gambit. But I'm having quite serious conversations saying, we can do this, but you need to do your part, which is, yeah, you need to start making the hard choices, because that's what leadership is about. And you need to be looking at workload and capacity management. And you need to meet us halfway, because all of the resilience sessions in the world isn't going to make a damn difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I often say that, you know, all this well-being stuff, I mean, it doesn't stick in organizations for three reasons. The first is it's not a strategic priority. The second is there's no organization accountability. Organization accountability to keep people healthy. So by God, I'll keep you physically safe. I say we spend billions in health and safety. Well, guess what? It all goes to safety. It all goes to keeping you physically safe at work. And I'm truly accountable as an organization. I mean, there are capital expenditure budgets to keep you safe at work. There are changes to processes and systems if there has been a fatality or an injury to keep you safe at work. There is huge organizational accountability to keep people safe. But I don't leave my emotions and my cognitive ability at the door when I walk in. So why do you only want to keep me physically safe? Why don't you also want to keep me emotionally and mentally safe and healthy? So there's no organization accountability. And the third reason, Jody, is there's no individual accountability. There's no individual accountability whatsoever. And so, yes, organizations can bring you in and teach people all sorts of tricks of the trade, et cetera, et cetera. And okay, individuals then take a bit of accountability. But then what's the organization also doing? And so for me, it's about both. It's about raising the levels of organization accountability to keep people healthy, but it's also driving a degree of individual accountability. And you know what I'd love to see on the individual accountability piece one day? Wow. Is that every single employee, as part of their development in a company, has a future fit plan. They haven't just got a skills development plan. They haven't just got a coach who looks after and helps them with their behaviors so that they'll perform better. They aren't sent on all sorts of conferences to increase and enhance their knowledge. They've also got a future fit plan. They've got a plan where they're discussing it twice a year with their line manager as to what are the things that they are doing to enhance the most valuable asset that they have, their health.
Love it. Love it. See the organizational accountability part. Can I dig into that a little bit? Your point about health and safety is really, really powerful. What do you think it is that makes them invest in the safety aspect?
It's simple. It's called legislation. Let me read you something.
Yeah.
This will bring it to life for you. Let me just read this to you. I'm just going to find it.
Because I thought you were going to say it was fear of being sued by death.
Well, let me read this to you. And this was, I did a talk to a bunch of health and safety professionals the other day, and I really challenged them on health and safety. And at the end of the talk, this wonderful lady, I don't know if I'm a bar or six, but she got hold of me on LinkedIn and said, I've just written this piece. Are you okay if I tag you and associate you with this piece? Because what you've just said, and she just puts it so much better than I could because she is a health and safety professional. Think about this for a moment. There's no organization accountability to keep people healthy at work. What does your organization do to protect your health? Anything? Nothing? A health week once a year? A benefit in kind access to a telephone GP? Contrast this with what your organization does to protect your safety. Investment, capital expenditure budget, RAMs, SSOWs, engineered controls, training, awareness sessions, PPE. Let's say there's been a workplace fatality, maybe a fall from a height, maybe struck by a moving object, perhaps an investigation. The organization implements changes to the process, the task, perhaps there's a court appearance and top management prosecution. There is accountability. What if the fatality was a suicide as a result of stress, depression, caused by work pressures, unachievable goals, workplace inequality, imposter syndrome, or any other factor? Reallocate tasks, recruit a replacement, business as usual. Where is the accountability for keeping people healthy at work?
Yeah. I think I actually saw that on LinkedIn. And it's a showstopper, isn't it? Because it really makes you go, bloody hell. And you said legislation. So because then it makes me think, is that where we need to work? It'd be very disheartening, and it's amongst other words that we have to legally make them accountable.
But you know what I'd love to see? And I just haven't got the time in the day to do this. But why can't we give tax incentives to those companies that truly enhance the health and the well-being of their people?
Mm.
rather than legislating,
why
can't we give a tax incentive? Because you know what? If I as a company am there to enhance the life of people and I invest all this stuff, fewer people are going to have to go and use the NHS, doctors, BUPA, whatever the case might be. So couldn't we incentivize in some way rather than the stick of legislation, you know, that kind of forces you to go down this route of making people healthy at work?
I love it.
I don't know.
But it's really interesting. But that's the type of thinking we need to do, because we need to go, okay, well, if we do this work, we're going to keep millions out of the system, potentially.
We'll save
billions.
Yeah.
So let's use that to incentivize people to do it and feed the machine.
Yeah. And you know what we've got now? We have got some very sophisticated tools that we can use to go in and survey and get a measure of the well-being of people in the organization. You know, you would have heard it in Unilever. What we treasure is what we measure.
Mm-hmm.
Look at it in safety. We've got all the measures in place. We've now got, I often say, engagement surveys. You know what engagement surveys measure? They measure people's willingness to go the extra mile. They measure people's capability to go the extra mile. What they don't measure is people's capacity to go the extra mile. Their ableness to... You know, when I was so ill in Unilever, Jodie, I had all the skills, all the knowledge, 20 years of experience. I mean, I had it all. But you know what I didn't have? I didn't have the capacity to. I didn't have the energy. I didn't have my health. So I couldn't go the extra mile. As willing as I was, I just couldn't. And I think that because we've got some of these sophisticated tools now, we can get a measure on the well-being and the capacity in organizations. And we should then begin to say, what those assessments also provide is such rich data on what are some of the things we've got to change in the organization to enhance the well-being, like what you've just mentioned, you know, whether it's workload, whether it's line management, behave, whatever. But we begin to get some data, which helps us to be more strategic in terms of the interventions that we will bring to the organization to create a place where people's lives are truly, truly enhanced by going to work.
And based on what you've just said, we're thinking about it as an afterthought, and actually it needs to be fundamental and foundational because you can't do anything without it, so it's not negotiable.
Nothing yet. That's why I want to change the performance management equation as a good old HR practitioner.
Yeah, yeah.
So I want the performance management equation to be the following. P equals performance equals knowledge plus skill plus behavior plus experience multiplied by health,
nice,
by energy. Because if energy is zero, mm-hmm, in that equation, P is zero.
Yeah. Love it. You got to get that out there. Maybe you have already. That's genius. These are the things that reframe people's thinking. It's these nuggets that get people to go, oh, hold on, you're so right. And even your point about the engagement surveys. I mean, certainly most of the companies we work with, they've only added in well-being into those surveys in the last 12 months.
One or two little questions. You know, do we care for your well-being? Do we protect your mental health? Two questions. Come on.
Vague and open to interpretation. And
exactly.
And that's because it's easy to ignore answers to questions you haven't asked. And so because you can, just from, and I know we've got to wrap up, just from this conversation though, I can see like 3, 4, 5 different opportunities where we can slowly make an incremental change. So if engagement surveys actually measured the things that we believe are important, it'll raise awareness, and then you cannot ignore it or you'll be seen as, you know, well, lots of very bad words, let's just say. And then beyond that, democratizing the conversation, but also democratizing the solution so it doesn't become extremely expensive and we leave people behind. And just your equation, that performance, that's genius, Jeff. I love that. You've got to get that mocked up and get that. But it's these things that make a difference when you bring something like an equation into common language in a way to reframe a conversation when it's so bloody obvious. When you've just said that, I'm like, damn straight. That's so right. Who can argue with that? You know, I love it.
Thank you, Jody.
I love this conversation. I know you have to.
Yeah, we could talk for hours.
Yeah.
We could talk for hours. Totally. And it's been, I just love the way you've rolled with this podcast. It's just been wonderful. It's the best podcast I've ever done, to tell you the truth. Best podcast I've ever done.
Really?
And I've done lots. Yeah, because there's kind of, you know, there've been questions beforehand and it's been, you know, this has just felt so natural and conversational.
Good.
Wonderful.
Good. Well, that's my style. And, you know, because we're like, I, the only thing that's missing is a beer, to be honest.
I'm a teetotaler, so I've got my water, but you might need your beer.
I've stopped, so is my husband.
Good.
But it's the quality of the conversation, isn't it? Like being in a pub and talking for 6 hours. We are going to do this again. I'm damn sure of it, and I can't wait. Thank you so much for your time and for everything. I love this conversation. It's you know, it's been a happy way to end what was a tiring day, and now I feel re-energized. So thank you so much.
And same to you. You've energized me as well. Okay. And I'm now going to start my weekend in the most beautiful part of the world, a little village called Hermanus in the Cape.
I just watched your octopus.
Oh, did you watch it? Yeah.
Amazing.
I know. Incredible, eh? Yeah.
I was crying and everything.
I know. It was fantastic. Incredible.
I just have pictures of you now diving into the water looking for your octopus on holiday.
Okay, Jodie. Lovely reconnecting. So nice to reconnect with
you. Yeah. Speak soon, Jeff. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Hidden Edge. Remember to subscribe and review and visit symbiotepartners.com for the latest on mental fitness for leaders and their teams.